This is a special report from True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers podcast.
James and Jennifer Crumbly, the parents of Oxford High School shooter Ethan Crumbly, were each sentenced to 10 to 15 years in prison for involuntary manslaughter today. We go now to the courtroom for that sentencing hearing.
I can't convey what losing Hannah has done to me. I miss her with every breath I take. I think going forward without her is something I'll never be able to fully navigate. I believe the word sad is inappropriate to use because it does nothing to capture the hurt or the way my soul shattered. I've never felt every atom of my body igniting from anger until Hannah was murdered. I didn't know what it was like to want to stop waking up in the morning until she wasn't here. I have never known pain that is forever until seeing Hannah in a casket. I didn't know it was possible to feel so isolated even when you're surrounded by people. I didn't know how it feels to not know yourself at all. I have no idea who I am without Hannah. She's my happy. She's my home. I look for Hannah in everyone I meet, every place I go, and it's exhausting when I'm met with disappointment every time. But it's the world. It's all the people she would have met. I grieve for them, too. To have that chance of Hannah being in your life taken away from you is a tragedy in and of itself. She's more of a person than you two combined times a trillion could ever even hope to be. But when the day comes that you re-enter society in 13 years, I hope you live more like Hannah. I hope you live every moment to the fullest like Hannah. I hope you laugh every day like Hannah. And I hope you love unconditionally like Hannah. That's it.
Thank you, Ray. Mr. St. Julian.
Thank you. I find myself in a rather odd state of mind today. Rather emotionally blank right now. Part of that is having to do this again. Part of that is I'm mostly a private person, and the idea of having to pour my heart out again is irritating. And I can't match the eloquent words that have come before me in the previous impact statements. So I'll limit my words today. The defendants, through their choices, through their indifference and gross negligence, enabled their son to murder my daughter, Hannah, and three other children. They chose to stay quiet. They chose to ignore the warning signs. And now, as we've heard through all of the objections, they continue to choose to blame everyone but themselves. Every single objection, I think, that the counsel said this morning, put the blame somewhere else, their son, not them. I stood before the court several months ago and spoke about the impact that Hannah's murder had on myself and my family. Nothing has changed since then. It's impossible for me to truly convey the complete impact of my daughter's loss. Hannah's murder has destroyed a large portion of my very soul. I've said these words before. It's still the truth. I remain a shell of the person that I used to be. I think of her and miss her constantly. Every day is a battle. To attempt to move forward, struggle to get out of bed, to go through the motions of everyday life. Simple everyday sights and actions bring pain, as I think what it should have been like with Hannah there with us. I think of all the good times that we've shared together as a family, and mourn all of the memories that will never be. I will never think back fondly on her high school and college graduations. I will never walk her down the aisle as she begins the journey of starting her own family. I am forever denied the chance to hold her or her future children in my arms. A few words describing Hannah can in no way fully capture her truly beautiful, caring soul, or impart her unlimited potential. Hannah was absolutely beautiful and thoughtful person. She was always the first person to notice when someone had a problem and the first to go out of her way to offer help. She was incredibly curious and talented. She continually tried new things. She crafted homemade jewelry, tried cooking her own recipes, and played several sports. She was a record holder in track and a leader of her school volleyball and basketball teams. She also hoped to join her older sister on the lacrosse team in the spring. She had aspirations of her career dedicated to helping people. All of this is lost because of the defendant's actions and choices. My position regarding the defendant's sentencing and their future has evolved through their trials. At first, I was focused on the importance of getting a guilty verdict, to have the message conveyed to the public that this type of behavior and choices are not acceptable. I didn't have strong feelings about their sentencing. It was just something that would be determined by the system. My view, however, has changed as the defendant's level of defiance has grown. Instead of acknowledging any mistakes, they continue to show no remorse. They take no accountability. They and their lawyers continue to try to change the narrative and portray the defendants as victims of the prosecution team. They blame everyone but themselves and make threats of retribution. The facts have already been presented. The jury has found them guilty. Multiple juries have found them guilty. Hannah, Madison, Tate, and Justin are the ones who have lost everything, not the defendants. As such, I ask that this court to sentence the defendants to the maximum allowable penalty of 10 to 15 years in prison. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. St. Julian. Thank you for being here. Mr. Muir.
Tate Muir's dad. First of all, Mark, Karen, the whole team. Strong work. Everybody said you couldn't do it, and you did it. For our family, it's not time to celebrate. This tragedy has taken an incredible toll on our family. So our family's not going to give the Crumley family a second of our time up here. It's time to turn our focus now. This is the low-hanging fruit. Now it's time to turn our focus to Oxford schools who played a role in this tragedy. You know, I hear this morning when we're listening to all the objections and hear Sharon talking about protecting the criminals, civil rights, constitutional rights. Where's my rights being protected? I fight for everybody in this room. My rights aren't being protected. Criminals' rights are more important than our rights, my rights. We are ready for our government to perform an investigation on this tragedy. Many don't know that our government has not investigated this murder. A pre-shooting investigation, a day of the shooting investigation, and a deep dive investigation into the horrible response to this tragedy, the disrespect shown to us families, the simple things like trauma training for somebody like a Sheriff Bouchard, who we got to talk to on the day that we got to go identify Tate. And he referred to Tate as a girl because he was too busy that night working to cover it up, instead of learning about every kid, Tate, Hannah, Justin, and Madison. It's time for the whole truth to come out. It's time to learn from this, from the purchase of the gun to the response. That's when real change happens, is when we can look at something and we can evaluate it, apply lessons learned. That's when real change happens. Is Hannah St. Juliana's family ready for the truth? Justin Shelley's family ready to hear the truth? Nicole Baldwin's family ready to hear the truth? Tate Mears' family's ready to hear the truth. Quit denying us that. It's time to drive real change from this tragedy.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. That concludes the victim impact statements. There's no one else. You're not presenting anybody else.
Correct.
Ms. Smith, what would you like to say on behalf of your client?
Your Honor, my client would also like to make a statement. Would you like
of
me to?
Of course.
Okay.
Of course. You may both allocate.
Thank
sure.
you. I didn't know what you really wanted to say.
Okay. Either way first. It's up to you. You or your client.
Would you like to go first or would you like me to go first?
I can go first.
Okay. Do I stay here?
You can stay there.
Your Honor, is there any way she can have this handcuff off? Because she has multiple pages.
I'm okay. I'm right here. I don't have to shuffle.
You're okay? Okay.
I don't know if I'm allowed to.
Okay. It's okay. She said she's okay.
It's okay.
Go ahead, Ms. Fonda.
I sit here today to express my deepest sorrow for the families of Hannah, Tate, Madison, Justin, and to all those affected on November 30th, 2021. The gravity and weight this has taken on my heart and soul cannot be expressed into words. Just as I know there is nothing I can say that's going to ease the pain and suffering of the victims and their families. There's a quote I heard that rang true. Grief. For those of you who understand, no explanation is needed. And for those of us who do not, no description is possible. I've taken countless nights of lament over the anguish and shame I carry. Knowing what my son did, the harm he caused innocent lives, the families, and to the entire Oxford community. I pray all the victims are the embodiment of God's mercy and peace, and that he heals your broken spirits. When I was on the stand, I was asked if I would have done anything different. I was horrified to learn my answer I would not have was completely misunderstood. That answer is true because my son did seem so normal. I didn't have a reason to do anything different. This was not something I foresaw. That was the intention of my answer and how I interpreted the question. Out of hindsight and information I have now, my answer would be drastically different. If I even thought my son could be capable of crimes like these, things would have absolutely been different. Even worse, when I learned during the police investigation that he had been planning a school shooting before November 30th. He was not the son I woke up. He was not the son I knew when I woke up on November 30th. The Ethan I knew was a good, quiet kid. He loved his pets, family vacations. My husband and I used to say we had the perfect kid. I truly believed that, and that's who I saw and thought I knew. As the details started emerging during discovery, I was horrified to learn concerning behaviors my son was reported doing at school. Refusing to take a makeup test, he told us he took. Sleeping in class. Drawing pictures of guns on his assignments. Writing, quote, "My family is a mistake." Watching a video in class of a mass shooting that fatal day. Along with internal communications that took place between his teachers and counselor, Mr. Hopkins. That he is, quote, "on my radar," and, quote, "he seems to be having a rough time," was never disclosed to us, his parents. The school claimed this was not abnormal behavior because of the pandemic and Oxford being in a, quote, "gun community." To say I was furious to learn this information is an understatement. This is not normal behavior to us and very different than what Ethan led us to believe was happening at school. Not only were you left in the dark about previous concerning behavior, but in the counselor's office that morning, none of those previous issues were brought to our attention. I can't stop thinking, had they have been, the conversation that morning would have been much different. That we would have taken a deep dive into what's really been going on with my son. I wonder if Hopkins and Ejak have those same regrets too. Instead, we are led to believe, not only from Hopkins and Ejak, but from Ethan as well, that this was an isolated event. We felt confident in trusting the professional's advice to let him stay in school that day. Quote, he does not pose a threat to himself or others. It was suggested that him being around peers would probably be good. We agreed. We were never asked to take him home that day. If that was discussed as the best course of action, we would have obliged. The prosecution keeps saying we didn't give them the big picture that morning in the counselor's office. But what they failed to acknowledge is the bigger picture the school did not give us. I'm not the same person I was prior to November 30th, 2021. This tragedy has changed who I am and has taught me some very valuable lessons. It said in suffering, we gain wisdom. I've also gained God. In the quiet hours of myself, I prayed to him about the deep impact this tragedy has had on the families and the endless pain no one should ever have to feel. For it is God who holds a true understanding of our pain. I've also learned to depend on him for peace and strength. Alone, I'm not strong enough. I've learned that we cannot tell or predict what will happen to us in this life. One day you wake up and everything can change. We can, however, decide what happens in us, how we take it, what we do with it. And that's what really matters in the end. That's the test of living, is how we take the unimaginable, the tragedies, the raw hardships, and make them a thing of worth and beauty. I've also learned to think, to never think this could not happen to you, and stereotype that bad kids come from bad parents. The prosecution has tried to mold us into the type of parents society wants to believe are so horrible only a school or mass shooter could be bred from. This is a very fatal assumption to have. We were good parents. We were the average family. We weren't perfect, but we loved our son and each other tremendously. Everything we strived for was to make sure our son had the best life we could give him, to grow up with traditions and experiences we had, to be the best person he could be. I know we did our best. The love I have for our son, mixed with regret for not seeing what was ahead, weighs heavily on me. My point is, this could be any parent here in my shoes. Ethan could be your child, to be your grandchild, your niece, your nephew, your brother, your sister. Your child can make a fatal decision, not just with the gun, but a knife, a vehicle, intentionally or unintentionally. If there's anything the general public can take away from this, is that this could happen to you too. The tragedy has taught me the true meaning of unconditional love as I watch my parents still love and care for me wholeheartedly, no matter what has happened. If there's nothing else I can do right in life, I do still love my son unconditionally, and perhaps that is my purpose. Your Honor, I don't envy the decision you have to make today. I understand this is a novel case, and punishment expectations are high, not just from the prosecution, but from all those affected as well. The heartbreaking journey these families have endured. Hang on, I have to back up. I missed my most important. I need to cross. The most valuable piece of wisdom I gained is the power of forgiveness. To forgive the prosecution for the slander and hate against me and my husband. Ms. McDonald, Mr. Keyes, I have hated you with deep anger, but hate is too heavy of a cross to carry. I need to be set free of that burden and recognize that you are people just like me, imperfect, but a child of God. I know he wants good things to happen to you, and in any conflict, whatever the circumstances, he is there loving both sides. To the victims and the families, I stand today not to ask for your forgiveness, as I know it may be beyond reach, but to express my sincerest apologies for the pain that has been caused. Your Honor, I don't envy you in the decision you have to make today. I understand the punishment expectations are high from all sides. This heartbreaking journey the families have endured is more than anyone should have to bear and acknowledge in its full depth. My time in confinement has been filled with deep remorse, regret, and grief over this tragedy. I have taken this one day at a time, trying to survive, navigate, and cope with the endless heartache, pain, and grief I feel for the families of Hannah, Justin, Madison, and Tate. I have also lost myself over my son's wrongdoing. I've been shredded by the public opinion of me, shamed as a horrible parent, pained to be a terrible person. But the worst hell I carry is my own self-judgment, remorse, and deep regret. I've been criticized that I don't show emotion. I'm unsympathetic. I don't cry enough. But alone I grieve. And if you were to look into me internally, you'd find I've died on the inside. I will be in my own internal prison for the rest of my life. Your Honor, I ask you to take consideration that I have been locked in a cell 23 hours a day, essentially in solitary confinement, for over 28 months, and that the court finds a fair and just sentence for me.
Thank you.
Yes, Your Honor, thank you. Your Honor, as I pointed out in my sentencing memo, this was a no-win case. When we walked in the door, there are no winners here. Every single person goes home loser.
Agreed.
And there's also no limit on the amount of sadness, grief, and horrific emotions that are felt across the board in this case. And when Mrs. Crumbly does express remorse, when she expresses sadness, there's a tendency, and there has been a tendency, for people to say she's shifting from sadness to the victims and putting it on herself. She's there's an abundance of sadness. There's enough sadness to go around for all of the victims, for Mrs. Crumbly, for everyone involved in this case. It's not surprising that the victims have come in and obviously want the maximum sentence. There has been a narrative throughout this case that they believe is true. And this court knows that there is other information that was not a part of this case. And I believe this court knows the defense was hugely hamstrung, and I think the court was pained at times over what to do. I'm talking about not being able to call the medical professionals, not being able to call the shooter to the stand, not being able to cross-examine on various pieces of evidence.
I'm not convinced the shooter would have helped you.
Okay, those, well, all of those are going to be are obviously issues, but there were things that hamstrung the defense. And I do believe
the forensic
records would have helped. And I understand the court has already ruled on that. I understand that. The tendency, though, after hearing the narrative that has been made public, has been to make Jennifer Crumbly sound like a monster, to vilify her, to make her sound like a horrible mother, an evil person. And the truth is, it's an effort to put her in a category of other, to say this is not something that could happen to any of us. And it is. It is something that could happen to any of us. And people fail to realize what the sentencing memo shows the court through numerous letters of support, that Mrs. Crumbly does have a kind heart. She does have compassion. She has spent night after night crying, not for only herself and her son, but also for the victims and for what her son did and what she will live with, knowing he did, and what she missed all the years forward. At the end of the day, we ask the court to look at Mrs. Crumbly's role in the offenses. We ask the court to consider that while she did not oppose having a gun in the home, she was not the person who was responsible for storing the gun and believed it was being stored properly and that it was locked. Mrs. Crumbly obviously testified, and all of the evidence at trial showed she believed there was a string lock, a cable lock, placed on the gun, on the weapon.
I don't mean to interrupt you, but that has really troubled me. Because you spent a lot of time talking about the fact that she didn't know anything about the gun. She didn't lock it, she wasn't responsible for it. But at one time she was texting her husband to see whether or not he got the gun and how much it was. She posted pictures of it as her son's Christmas present. She shot the gun. And I don't know if you're aware of this. I don't know if either side was aware of this, but the first jury determined that there was solely a defendant, James Crumbly. And Mrs. Crumbly testified that when she returned from the range with the shooter on November 27th, it was the defendant, James Crumbly, who was responsible for the 6 hour retreated from the car and was supposed to keep it safe. The first jury recognized that the GPS admitted in the case shows that even prior to the defendant James Crumbly returning to the house, the shooter was videotaping the unlocked sink shower in the kitchen of the home. So that's not true. That's not true. She also testified that a key to the cable lock was kept in the beer stein in the kitchen. But it's clear that the cable lock was clearly never opened.
Your Honor, the jury's finding about the timing of the GPS and when the gun video was made is not correct. The evidence at trial did not support that. We know that's not correct. Mrs. Crumbly left the gun in the car so that James Crumbly could put the gun in the house and store it correctly. Mrs. Crumbly, there were multiple cable locks in that house because there was more than one cable lock. There was not just the cable lock that was on the Sig Sauer. There was more than one.
I didn't recall him.
There were not more than one found, but whatever Ethan Crumbly did with the cable lock from the Sig Sauer, we don't know.
The gun wasn't locked.
Your Honor, jury, okay. Factually, during Mrs. Crumbly's trial, it was not proven that the gun was not locked. I don't know what happened at James Crumbly's trial.
You know about his statements? That gun was never locked.
Whose statements?
Mr. Crumbly's statements.
Mr. Crumbly and Mrs. Crumbly talked about how the gun had been locked. In all of the evidence I saw, well, Your Honor, obviously
go on. I don't think the evidence has shown that she had no involvement with the gun.
I'm not saying no involvement. I said she supported the gun. She didn't object to the gun. But when it came down to it, probation writes in her narrative that she taught her son how to use the gun, and it's very obvious watching the evidence in the trial that she was not the one teaching him how to use the gun.
There's no evidence that she taught him how to use the gun.
When Mrs. Crumbly spoke, she acknowledged what the testimony was at trial about all of the different things that she wished had come to her attention from the school employees. And the prosecutor's office has said that the proposal the defense has made regarding Mrs. Crumbly is a slap in the face, and what's truly a slap in the face, not only to the victims in this case, but also to the Crumblies, is how much the Oxford schools did fail the Crumblies and all the victims. Because if Mrs. Crumbly had been presented any of those five things, things would be different, and we would probably not be here today. I am asking this court, I know the court of public opinion is running high right now, emotions are running very high. There are many, many complicated issues with this case. It is a dynamic and different case than most cases. Mrs. Crumbly does have a good heart. This is a woman who had no felony history. She's a working mom who was very busy, did have a hobby. I'm just saying, largely the evidence at trial were some of those things, and Mrs. Crumbly did have an enormous amount of love for her son, and what she has been painted out to be in the media and throughout this case, and even throughout the victim impact statements today, is just not congruent with the people who know Mrs. Crumbly and know her heart. It's also not congruent with the text messages she sent right after the shooting about how she wished she would have died instead of one of the kids.
I don't think the verdict was about how feeling she is or how sad she is. I think the verdict was about behaviors that led up to that day.
Well, there has been an enormous amount of criticism about whether or not she's sad enough, and there was cross-examination extensively about whether she cried or not enough on the stand, or when during the videos that were played of police interviews and things like that. And then, on the same hand,
I don't doubt that they were both in shock. I don't doubt that.
And at the end of the day, though, when she did cry, there was an objection about crying. And so Mrs. Crumbly, from the very beginning, has been damned no matter what way she went. This was the most horrific thing that could have happened to the community, to the victims, to these families. Absolutely horrific. At the end of the day, however, it's a unique and complicated case, and that is why I proposed the sentence I did. I don't believe the sentencing guidelines take into account the very unique situation that we have in this case with a young man who will be in prison forever. I'm asking the court to keep that in mind, and please keep in mind the other arguments throughout the memo.
I think you know that I read everything you send me.
I do, and I appreciate that. Thank you.
Do you want to respond now, or do you want to counter from the side first?
I prefer just to be able to respond once, Your Honor.
Are you okay with that?
That's fine, Your Honor.
All right, would you like to address the court, or would you like your client to address the court first?
Would you like to address the court, James?
I would.
Yes, Your Honor. Mr. Crumbly will address the court. For the record, he does have something typed out that I typed out for him, so it was bigger. It's easier for him to read, Your Honor.
Okay.
You can't. No, she said she cannot tell them to go. Your Honor, there was some confusion about whether or not he could get his second handcuff off. I was just clarifying. The court said she cannot tell the sheriff's office.
Does he have to keep that handcuff off?
Yes, ma'am. I was just clarifying, Your Honor. Thank you.
Before I address this court directly, I want to do something that I have never been able to do throughout this time until now. I want to say I can't imagine the pain and agony that the families that have lost their children and what they're experiencing and what they're going through. As a parent, our biggest fear is losing our child or our children. And to lose a child is unimaginable. My heart is really broken for everybody involved. I understand my words are not going to bring any comfort. I understand that they're not going to relieve any pain. And quite frankly, they probably just don't believe me. However, I really want the families of Madison Baldwin, Hannah St. Juliana, Tate Meyer, Mir, and Justin Schilling to know how truly sorry I am and how devastated I was when I heard what happened to them. I have cried for you and the loss of your children more times than I can count. I know your pain and loss will never go away. Part of you will be missing forever. But please know that I am truly very sorry. I am sorry for your loss as a result of what my son did. I cannot express how much I wish that I had known what was going on with him or what was going to happen. Because I absolutely would have done a lot of things differently. Again, my heart pours out to every single one of you. It really does. Judge Matthews, I'm not gonna overdo a lot of things that were already said. But I know the full amount of pressure that you have on you and the responsibility that has been placed on you throughout this case. I have the utmost respect for you, and I'm simply going to ask that you sentence me in a fair and just way. I went over my trial and heard the evidence that was presented against me. You know that what my son did, I was not aware of, or that he was planning it, or that he obtained access to the firearms in my house. There was absolutely no evidence that suggested that. As my attorney has told you, I've been on lockdown for 23 hours a day. I've not been able to speak to my son since November 30th, and I have not been able to speak with my wife since December 3rd. I know that I have experienced pales in compassion to what those families who've lost their children and countless other victims experience every day because of what my son did. But I want you to know I too grieve for everyone, as I have explained, for everyone that's been affected by what my son pled guilty to doing. And I'll continue to feel this pain for the rest of my life as well. If I could go back and change things, if I could go back and do things differently, and maybe none of us would be here today. So again, I ask your honor to impose a just and fair sentence based on the truth about what you heard during my trial. I'm asking the court to sentence me to time served and place me on probation for the maximum time allowed with the GPS tether for as long as the court deems necessary. I also want to address one last thing. And that's to what Tate Mears' dad said. It is time that we all know the truth. We have been prohibited from telling the whole truth. The whole truth has not been told. And I'm with you, Mr. Mayor. I too want the truth. Because you have not had it. You have not had the truth at all. The truth has not been presented to you. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cummings. Ms. Staley, are you wanting this petition? Go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. I did submit a sentencing memorandum, Your Honor. I'm not going to belabor the points that I made in my memorandum, as I do believe that it was thorough. However, I do want to note for the court that, especially in statements that have been made about James, that he lacks remorse, that he doesn't feel bad, that he's trying to put off responsibility on everyone but himself, that he's allegedly made threats toward the elected prosecutor. Your Honor, in some of the same calls that the prosecution has tried to use and has quoted in their own sentencing memorandum and attached as exhibits to their memorandum, as I noted in my sentencing memorandum, Your Honor, James also said in those very same calls that he wished that he had known what his son was capable of. That if he had known, if he had been made aware of these things, if he had known that his son had obtained access to a firearm, that maybe he could have saved the four children's lives. That maybe he could have saved a lot more than that. Your Honor, there has never been a time that James Crumbly has not acknowledged what happened in this case. He has felt horrific grief for not only the families, but for the people who have been affected. He's grieved for himself, for his own child. And while that may not be something that is a popular statement to make, he's grieved for the child that he believed he had. Not the child who pled guilty, but the child that he believed he had on the morning of November 30th when he dropped his son off at school. James could not have predicted what his son was going to do that day. He couldn't have predicted because he didn't know that it was going to happen. As James said, Your Honor, you sat through the trial, Judge. You heard the evidence that was presented. You also know that there was no indication given in the evidence presented that James had knowledge of what his son was planning, that James didn't know that his son had been accessing that firearm unsupervised, or that he had access to the firearm unsupervised. Judge, you heard that firearm was stored legally at the laws at the time, in November of 2021. That there may be differing opinions on whether or not that firearm was stored responsibly, Your Honor, but it was stored legally. It was stored unloaded. It was stored with the ammunition stored separately. Your Honor, James Crumbly did and made the decisions that he thought were right. Based on the information that he had, even on the morning of November 30th at the school, you've heard multiple times that James had no knowledge of what his son was intending to do later that day. That even the school officials, the people who were trained, they talked about the special training that they had during trial. Even those individuals said that they did not believe that James's son was a threat to other people. That they had concerns about his sadness, Your Honor.
They had at a minimum concerns about his danger to himself, right?
Correct, Your Honor. Danger to himself due to his level of sadness, that they wanted him to go talk with somebody, but that it wasn't so emergent that he needed to be removed immediately.
And isn't it the reason they didn't want him to go home?
Your Honor, there's some dispute as to whether or not the testimony from the school is accurate as to what actually occurred in that office. And Judge, I don't want to try and retry the case. I don't think it serves anyone or benefits anyone. But I do want this court to be aware, and Your Honor, you observed James during the trial. You're aware that he had he had difficulties throughout the trial. He showed emotion. He struggled with some of the things that he heard and saw.
I don't know how anyone could have.
I agree, Your Honor. I agree. And as I've acknowledged numerous times throughout this case and throughout the trial, it is an incredibly emotional trial. Today is incredibly emotional for everyone involved. I echo what Ms. Smith said. There are no winners here. Everyone has lost in this case.
I think that Ms. Smith said your sentencing memo that's possible to stand for everyone here, not just the victims from the families as well. It is possible to stand for everyone.
And I agree with that, Your Honor. I did ask the court to sentence James to time served. I am going to echo his request for a period of supervision with a GPS tether. I understand that the court, we did object to some scoring. I understand that, again, the court has significantly strong pressure. The emotions run high in this case, Your Honor. I don't envy what you have to do. However, I am asking that you consider my request. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thanks.
Your Honor, I just have to correct some facts. The allegations that Jennifer and James Crumbly were left in the dark just are not true, and the evidence at trial does not show that. The evidence presented at trial that as late back as March, the 9th, 17th, and the 20th, text messages about from their son to Jennifer Crumbly that he was seeing things in April. His text messages to his friends indicate he asked for help. His mother laughed at him. April 20th, Jennifer told his friend's mother that he was depressed. There were multiple visits to the gun range. There was two guns purchased for him. The Crumblies were aware that he was struggling in school, and that they had a rather critical fight the night before, which is all detailed, incidentally, and as well as where the gun actually was in the shooter's statements, his plea, and the multiple statements he made to the psychiatrist, the very same things. They stand here and say, if only we could have called them. Well, calling those individuals would have resulted in all of the claims that's inconsistent with what he said, and it's inconsistent with what the psychiatrist testified to in the Miller hearing. So I had no intention of addressing this, but it was brought up, so I feel as if I have to, and I have a duty to do so. They were concerned. The evidence showed that. They were very concerned. They were concerned about the drawing, and they were concerned based on the fact that they were called to school. Jennifer Crumbly's own statements acknowledges she was called to the school. They wanted him to get help. She said she had to go back to work, but they said that he could stay. None of that, by the way, is in dispute, and that she left. This insinuation that if only I had known he was sleeping in class and teachers might have been concerned, then none of this would have happened, is at the core of why you saw six people standing here and saying there's no remorse or accountability. And I want to be clear, remorse does not sound like I feel really bad. I'm sure they do. I don't dispute they feel bad. I don't dispute they have grief. That's not the kind of remorse and accountability these victims are looking for. What that looks like is, we messed up. We should have done this, and we didn't, and we are very sorry. And that has not happened, which is what we're talking about here, and what you heard the victims say. I don't want to belabor any more than we had to in the trial. I have a deep respect for Ms. Lehman, but the facts of this and the elements of this case simply are not that the prosecution had to show that he had actual knowledge and he could predict and he knew exactly what his son was going to do. Those are not the elements of the crime. It's not what the jury was required to find, and it has nothing to do with their actual conviction. Jennifer Crumbly and James Crumbly were not convicted based on a narrative. They were not convicted because somebody thought they were a bad or good parent. Those two trials involved multiple motions and objections over evidence that the court sustained. We did not allow the jury to present the information about Jennifer Crumbly that her lawyer made a strategic decision to, in the middle of a trial, say, open the door, you can bring it all in, was not due to the prosecution's requests or actions. But you can't seek to exclude evidence and then allow somebody to testify to an inconsistent with the evidence. The last thing I want to say is there is case law that the court's aware of about what the court can consider in fashioning a proportional sentence. And we don't give power or authority to victims to decide or render verdicts, with good reason. But we should not, and we cannot, sanitize their pain or the weight of the impact or chalk it up to it's emotionally charged, as if everything that's happened here is because people sitting here are too emotional and they pressure people, because that just simply isn't true. And not only should you consider the weight and the impact of the defendant's actions and inactions, you are required to, pursuant to the case law. It is one of the factors to consider, the severity and the impact of the crime. We've heard a lot about it's not what happened in the school. And while I understand that the negligence, the gross negligence that occurred happened before what happened in that day when he left that bathroom and started firing the 9mm and killing four kids. I understand that, but it is absolutely about what James and Jennifer did and what they didn't do and the gross negligence that caused those acts. This is what it looks like. This is what it looks like. When two parents have the ability and are in the best position and have the most knowledge and need to protect other kids, and they do nothing. This is what it looks like. They do nothing, and then they come here today, and they claim they're victims of the school, of the prosecution, of the emotional tensions, of public opinion. But there were two long and rigorous and detailed trials that included multiple victims and witnesses who testified under oath with hundreds of exhibits presented to the juries, with the safeguard of this court allowing what they could see and what they couldn't see, and they were defended by two attorneys aptly and vigorously. That is what this conviction is about. And when fashioning a sentence, it is absolutely critical that you listen and consider the impact of what that gross negligence cost. So we're asking you to exceed the guidelines, because I believe all of the factors pursuant to the case law, with the necessary consideration of the impact of these crimes, justifies you to do. We're asking you, the people are asking you, Your Honor, to consider the devastating impact of their gross negligence that was foreseeable. Help me. Blood everywhere. The world is dead. All the while, a 9mm had just been purchased for him, and he 50 rounds of ammunition. Both things can be true, Your Honor. You can fashion a proportionate sentence, but not ignore the unimaginable loss and the grief that these parents are enduring. Because they will never get back another moment with Tate or Hannah or Justin or Madison. And this is what it looks like. Thank you.
Thank you. I guess I would like to say briefly to the families, considering your immeasurable grief, it's completely understandable to hate everything associated with these proceedings. I spent both trials looking out at all the family members, and I wondered to myself, I was looking straight on at Mr. St. Giuliano, whether or not he'll ever smile again. And that's very difficult. I'm very aware of my job in the situation, very aware of my job to not be swayed by public opinion, by media, by any of those different things. I can't and will not pretend to understand the pain the families are experiencing, but I did sit through these trials with you. I saw what you saw, I heard what you heard, so I can and will offer my deepest and most sincere condolences for your unfathomable losses. It's as I just said, it's not my role, it's not the role of the court system to make an example of the defendants. However, it is a goal of sentencing to act as a deterrent. These charges are not jury edicts about gun ownership or keeping the gun in a private home. All of the jurors in both trials agreed that they understood that. Parenting is a complex job. Parenting practices around the world share the goals of ensuring health and safety, preparation for life as a productive adult, and transmission of cultural values. Parents are not expected to be psychic. But these convictions are not about poor parenting. These convictions confirm repeated acts or lack of acts that could have halted an oncoming runaway train. About repeatedly ignoring things that would make a reasonable person feel the hair on the back of their neck stand up. Opportunity knocked over and over again, louder and louder, and was ignored. No one answered, and these two people should have and sure didn't. Mr. Crumley, it's clear to this court that because of you, there was unfettered access to a gun or guns, as well as ammunition in your home. You characterized yourself as a martyr and threatened the well-being of the prosecutor. Mrs. Crumley, you glorify the use and possession of these weapons. Your attitude toward your son and his behaviors was dispassionate and apathetic. Your response to school staff after a 12-minute meeting was, "Are we done here?" During your trial, you announced that you wouldn't do anything different. I understand that that might have been misinterpreted, but it did cut the victims deep. Because of both of your actions and inaction, among many, many other things, the world is missing out on a top college university will miss out on Tate's star quality football skills. I met Raina, who's wise beyond her years, and she's told us that among many, many other things, community will be denied Hannah's kindness, creativity, and sense of humor. Among many, many other things the world will miss is Madison's kind and loving soul and the light that reflected her beauty both inside and out. Although a hero in death because of his organ donations that helped so many, we will never know where Justin, an excellent student with vast skills and interests, described as a mentor and a leader, would have left his giant imprint. The impact statements given here and the written statements provided to the court describe the cataclysmic impact the deaths of these children have had on their children. With regard to each defendant, this court has spent night and day thinking about this case, as you can imagine. I've prayed about this case, I've thought about this case, and I've considered the possibility for rehabilitation, the need to protect society, the penalty appropriate to the conduct and goal of deterring others from similar conduct. I have reviewed the pre-sentence investigation reports. I am, of course, sadly familiar with the facts and circumstances of these cases, as well as those surrounding each defendant. The advisory sentencing guidelines in this matter do not capture the catastrophic impact of the acts or inaction in these matters. The guidelines do not take into account the complete lack of insight both defendants have for their behavior to this very day. The guidelines do not account for the severity of the circumstances in this matter. The guidelines ignore the survivors, including shooting victims Phoebe Arthur, Elijah Mueller, Riley Franz, Kylie Osage, John Asciutto, Molly Darnell, and Aiden Watson. They were deeply wounded, both physically and emotionally. In addition to the seven wounded, each of the defendants' gross negligence has caused unimaginable suffering to hundreds of others as a result of what happened that day. Each act or inaction created a ripple effect. Therefore, an out-of-guidelines sentence is appropriate and proportional. The court uses the useful tool of the legislative guidelines, which embody the principles of proportionality, while also taking into account the nature of the offense and the background of each defendant. I believe that the following sentences would be in the best interest of justice and are reasonable and proportionate to the seriousness of the matter and the circumstances surrounding each defendant. With regard to Jennifer Crumley, it is the sentence of this court, Ms. Crumley, that you served 10 to 15 years with the Michigan Department of Corrections. You will have credit for 858 days. State costs are $272. There's a crime victim's rights fee of $130. You and your agents may not have any contact with the families of Madison Baldwin, Tate Meir, Hannah St. Juliana, and Justin Schilling. I will issue another ruling with regard to contact with your son, the shooter. Excuse me. As to defendant James Crumley, it is the sentence of this court that you served 10 to 15 years with the Michigan Department of Corrections, that you receive credit for 858 days, that you pay state costs in the matter of $272, that there is a crime victim's rights fee of $130, that you or your agents have no contact with the families of Madison Baldwin, Tate Meir, Hannah St. Juliana, and Justin Schilling. Ms. Wheeler, have I left anything out with regard to sentencing? No restitution has been requested by any of the families at this time, correct?
That's correct.
Thank you. I would like to advise both defendants that you are entitled to appellate review of your conviction and sentence, including that the sentence exceeds the guideline range. This is done by filing a claim of appeal by right, or when you are not entitled to file a claim of appeal by right, an application for leave to appeal. If you cannot afford to hire an attorney to represent you on appeal and you request an attorney may be appointed for you. You may request an attorney by completing the request for appointment of attorney section of the form that will be provided for you and by returning the form to this court or to the Michigan Assigned Counsel System at the address on the form. If you wish to preserve your automatic right to appeal, the form must be received within 42 days after sentencing. If you do not submit the form within 42 days from today, you may still file an application for leave to appeal if the form is received within 6 months after sentencing. Do each of the defendants acknowledge receipt of their appellate rights?
James acknowledges receipt, Your Honor. He's completing the form as we speak.
Your Honor, my client is as well. Would the court like the forms here, or would you prefer us to?
It doesn't matter either way.
Okay.
Either way.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'm going to ask that everyone remain seated while the defendants are taken out of the courtroom. I think they're going to finish their appointments.
They are going to, Mr. Crumley is going to finish his form,
right.
Your Honor.
We'll wait for that.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I would just ask that no one stand up. It makes the deputies nervous. Thank you.
witnesses.
This has been a special report from True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers Podcast.